Welcome to The Ugly Podcast, the place where creatives are encouraged to make messy, ugly art and to redefine their relationship to their inner critic. Every other week, I am joined by creatives of all mediums and methods to discuss our creative processes and how we navigate the mental minefield of creativity. This podcast serves as a reminder that you and your art get to be whatever the hell you want to be, ugly and all. Welcome back to The Ugly Podcast. I'm your host, Lauren Alexander. I use they, them pronouns, as you all know. And I have a great guest for you all today. My guest is known as the Pineapple Lady and is a licensed mental health counselor, board certified art therapist, researcher, and multidisciplinary artist. She serves as the CEO of Pineapples with Purpose, a pioneering mobile health service introducing art therapy to communities affected by race-based traumatic stress. Some of her recent accomplishments include being an Arts in Medicine Fellow, Baldwin for the Arts Fellow, Culture of Art Leadership Institute Fellow, and the current artist in residence at the Ferret House. Welcome to my guest. Would you please introduce yourself with your name and your pronouns, please?
Yes, my name is April Fitzpatrick, and I use she, her pronouns.
Amazing. Welcome. I'm so happy to have you here. First and foremost, can you tell me a little bit more about your mobile art therapy practice? That sounds just so truly amazing.
Yeah, so I have a bit of a great history in traditional clinical practice, working across various settings, from schools to rehabilitation centers, psychiatric hospitals, outpatient facilities, and so juvenile justice centers. And so in all of these spaces, there was always a commonality or a type of grieving moment of like, what happens next? Mm-hmm. Like, and so I became very, I was always kind of aware and interested in community work, but looking at how art therapy and mental health in general, the landscape and the language and the expectation can be transformed into community practice, which for me looks at the accessibility, the availability, the appropriateness. And so I thought about mobile mental health as a way to go into communities and reach communities to lessen all the barriers that sometimes prevent people from getting quality care and the continuation of it. So taking advantage of passive experiences as well while challenging the traditional model of therapy.
Yeah, I love
so
that.
It's rooted out of collaboration. So
that's so good. Amazing. And then pineapples are a big part of what you do, both in your art and in your and in your therapy practice. What is the, where did that idea come from? What does it symbolize for your work and for the people that you work with?
Right, right. Well, first, I like to give you a gift. I know we're not a virtual pineapple gift.
Oh, my gosh.
If we were in person.
I love it.
But give me your address. I can always mail it.
So good. Wait, can you describe what you just showed me? Since this?
Right. So I make these kind of like, what size is this? Oh, these very intimate process-based spin on the pineapple. And so I look at it in various ways and then, you know, manipulate them using watercolor and markings. And so it's heavily rooted in just process because I'm very much process over product. So it's two pineapple quarters, I guess, on the corners of a white sheet of paper filled with your typical colors of what you would think about the pineapple, as well as other colors, inflorescent colors and purples and greens and oranges.
I love it.
Yeah. So the pineapple, first the pineapple came to me just as a personal symbol, and just understanding myself, because symbols have the power to like integrate the conscious world and the subconscious world. And I think that in general, it just represented my life narrative of like these spikes and this crown that grew in relation to things that were occurring, but me always knowing like the sweet inner core. But when I started to do therapy work, a large part of therapy is like relationship building and therapy to rapport. And so sometimes it's spiky.
Yeah.
Not everybody is willing to let you in, as they should not be. And so it became a way to symbolically represent welcoming people into tough conversations, uncomfortable conversations. So that when things come up and we experience things across this mental health landscape, the pineapple grounds us back.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I would find is that no matter the conversation, whether it stuck, it didn't, whether it was challenging or comforting, what people remember when they left was the pineapple.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I really wanted to happen, because it was the power of symbolism and giving somebody the agency to understand their own narrative through this symbolic thing. And an overall mood booster.
Yeah.
And those are very simple steps that are required when we think about changing one's perspective.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I love the idea of, you know, the spikes on the outside, they're not bad. They just are.
Mm-hmm.
So even when you have that kind of spiky exterior of protection, that's not bad. That is
right.
That's how you were formed to protect yourself. And that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
How do we honor those things? Because, you know, we're so quick to call a thing a thing. Say, oh, that's a defense mechanism. And it's like, I mean, and also, there's so many reasons why there's the pineapple. So, I mean, it was a personal thing. Then that activated, how can I use this to engage with people?
Mm-hmm.
And then I actually started to look at the symbolic facts of the pineapple.
Mm-hmm.
So the pineapple is made up of 200 flowers that form together to form the fruit. Mm-hmm. So I was like, mind blown, because I'm like, behind this spike is an actual flower.
Yeah, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So then I went down a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
I'm like, put me on Jeopardy. Like, anything.
Category
telling.
Is pineapples.
Right. I got you. It takes 3 years to grow. It was just all these magnificent facts that truly aligned with, for me, human development and what it needs to thrive and to know. So, yeah, I started to use it as like a guiding metaphor.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I didn't realize that they took 3 years to grow. That works so well with like a therapy model of like whatever you are working on, whatever you're cultivating, it might take 3 years to grow. It's not gonna,
exactly.
It's not gonna just sprout up overnight. Oh God, that's so good.
I mean, the therapeutic relationship,
listen,
it can take up to a year itself before you truly feel like you are one with your therapist, and it has nothing to do with like the skill training per se, or the different uniqueness of personalities. Is really like the process and the time it takes to be in a relationship with someone.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So good. All right. Let's just talk about you. How has creativity moved throughout your life? Were you always super in touch with your creativity?
I feel like I was. I was a very creative child, very inquisitive, very multi-projects. What are we doing? Very curious, you know, that probably became limited due to the structure of the household and school. So, but I've always considered myself a creative, and can go back into early memories and being in art shows and really being invested in art lessons. Along the way, traditional academia kind of preceded that. And I think what happened is that my art was suppressed in one way and started to emerge in another way.
Mm-hmm.
So public speaking and dance became a part of my life for a while. But at the time, I wasn't viewing it as like creativity.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you know, me being on the dance team.
Right.
And yeah. And so I found art again in college.
Nice. Did you feel like school then was the thing that like kind of suppressed the like the artist urge in like the sense of drawing or mm-hmm. like using more physical I mean, you said not, obviously not physical. You said you danced, but but I guess the things that, you know, we typically associate with like having an outcome or like a piece that comes out of your creativity.
Right. I mean, in some ways I do, because I mean, you could always choose art as an elective, right? Mm-hmm. But it wasn't an integral part of like all the curriculums. And now mm-hmm. we're in a space where we can find creativity in all fields and all disciplines. Mm-hmm. So I think there was a lot of binary and dichotomized thinking in traditional school settings where it had to be this right or wrong, either correct or incorrect. And I mean, I can attribute a few courses that allow like debate class or theories of knowledge where all we did was like question things. But again, those one-offs, when they're not a part of like the everyday experience.
Yeah.
Then yes, I do think that, you know, it becomes limiting.
Yeah.
It's supposed to suppress.
Yeah. This is the thing that like, it gives me so much rage when like traditional school and like often like master's programs or like post-bac programs that like are art focused and ends up like hurting people's actual creativity because they think that there is one way of doing things. And it breaks my heart. It makes me so mad.
Or even when they're not prepared for the art that the person is creating.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
When that's in the traditional lens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you know, it's like, wait, what? So it's not, is this abnormal? Like something's wrong with mm-hmm. you.
Yeah.
It's like, no, this is my experience of the world.
Yeah. I did an episode with M. Eifler, who is a artist and disability advocate and does a lot of work with like their own disability in their art. And they did a master's program of art. And for their like final project, it was this this video game that you couldn't beat. And as you played it, the video game like deteriorated. Mm. And that was their art. And like the people who were judging it, the teachers who were giving them the final grade, we're like, this mm-hmm. isn't art. This is like a social justice project or whatever. And they're like, how is this not art? Like, what are you talking about? Like, absolutely insane. Yeah. Your face right now. I love it.
Okay.
Just over okay. it. Just so over it.
Right. And at what expense do, you know, the advocating for yourself, mm-hmm. right? But at what expense do you put yourself? I don't know. It's just, I don't know. That just speaks like trauma and re-traumatizing. Like, mm-hmm. because clearly your identity, your success and grade is wrapped up in this, right? To move to the next phase, right?
Right.
Yeah. Mm-mm. No. Mm-hmm.
Right. And speaking of our fury for society, as an art therapist, how do you see our society's drive for that product, that performance, that like one way of, you know, what is art? How do you see that inhibiting our health and our healing?
Yeah, it is in the way. It is definitely in the way because... One, I mean, what it tells people is that, you know, who is invited, who's not invited, whose voice is worthy, voice is not worthy. Mm-hmm. I think there's a level like of trickery of the mind of like moving the glass ceiling, right? Mm-hmm. Because who is holding like the performance culture? The grind culture to like, you know, prove something. And you're pulling people further away from their intuitiveness, their trust within themselves, and just giving room for the inner critic to be louder, mm-hmm. Which for some people can turn into like a internal war and for others a complete shutdown.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's no space to heal or just to have or to even just be.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are all creatives. Like, we are reflections of nature, inward, turn outward. So it's just like, yeah, I don't think it's by happenstance, but it's definitely in the process, because even neuroscience speaking, they talk about how much fear is such a like innate response that needs nothing. It just comes up like millions of thoughts that your brain has versus how hard it is to then integrate yourself into like positive thinking and positive self-talk. And a lot of questions like, why is it harder, you know, to do the positive steps, and why can't we wake up with just positive, you know, thinking? And so if in fact the world is further creating this experience, right, a performance, like you're keeping people in that state because they're responding to something that like out of fear, or trying to fix or trying to accomplish, rather than accepting that like you were made how you were made, and there's a lot of substance and wisdom and opportunity that can come out of it, and there's no need to extend outwardly for those answers, or, you know, experience. So I definitely think it's in the way.
Yeah.
I'm anti-performance culture.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It, that turning away from our intuition, from our innate connection with nature and just existing, it turns us into little, you know, little robots for the system that just go through the process. And like, they know that we're afraid, and they know they prey on that fear. And yeah, the less we actually lean on our own intuition, lean on each other, our innate humanness, the easier it is to just keep us manipulated and small and powerless.
Yeah. Even when I'm in therapy, and I sometimes can get, I see a client on a variety. So whether they are very like highly logical people and need product, or they're highly emotive people, they want a task. Like, they, you know, I want to be like fixed. And I asked them, I was like, you know, I can give you all the worksheets in the world. I'm like, but are you completing these like for performance reasons, to show yourself that like you're working on something? Are you, you know, trying to look at the product, you know, to measure up against, you know, who you are? Because if you are like that, that's not what therapy is, at least, you know, in my scope of practice and how it really works. And you might do yourself more hindering and harm. Because what happens if you have a successful session and you complete the worksheet, and then something goes out in society and happens, or you wake up and still don't feel good the next day, you know? And I think that too inhibits the process of healing, because we go in with this very rigid expectation, and by 6 months and by a year, I'm going, and it's like, well, life is going to keep happening, so we really don't know. Something else may occur in 6 months.
Yep, it feels like you're just speaking to me right
now. Oops.
this is something that I know about myself, and I know I'm actively working on it right now, because I've seen it so much, especially right now, where my desire to just fix something and have it be done and away from me is feeling tortured right now, because there is no way to fix what is going on in the world right now like that. It's going to take time. It will probably take my lifetime to continue working for justice, for liberation, for all people. And my brain is like, we have to fix it now. And it's like, you have to continue. Like, you have to get into the process. You cannot focus on the like end product, because you might not even be alive to see it. I hope I am. I so hope I am, but like, you just don't know. Right. And so, yeah, my, and I mean, part of that so much just, it seems like that's so much of the society that we live in of just like, you get things now, you, mm-hmm. if something is broken, you throw it out, you get a new one.
Right.
We can't just throw out society right now. We have to like delve into it and delve into ourselves. Oh yeah. You, I'm so glad you said all that. Cause that is definitely what I'm struggling with right now.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a large struggle when I came to this residency. Mm-hmm. Because like I said, I came straight from a psych hospital for 2 years. So it's like, it's a different, it's just a different level of intensity. And when I had the time to pause, I was like, well, why aren't you creating art? Like, why aren't you creating anything? Like, you need to be producing. Mm-hmm. And then 3 months had gone past and I hadn't created anything. And I was freaking out like, oh my God. I only have 9 more months left. Uh-huh. And then I had to pause. I'm like, but you've literally been drinking more water. Like, mm-hmm. you have been resting. Mm-hmm. You have been walking and exploring the new neighborhood you now live in. You've been watering plants. You've been cooking meals in a very, like, intimate, slow-paced, can-I-think-about-the-ingredients type of way. You've been able to, like, call your grandfather, you know, and spend 15 minutes seeing check-ins. And it just felt like how much we desensitize and become disconnected from the things that really matter. Mm-hmm. That's also going to keep us healthy to fight the fight that we want to fight. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Yeah. I'm in it too. I'm in it with you as well.
I'm so glad we're not alone. We have this idea that everything we do has to be good or have value. This belief leads us to burnout. It can hold us back from creating altogether. But in my Ugly Art 101 course, I break down these restrictive beliefs and lead you through exercises that intentionally subvert perfectionism and bring playfulness back into your creative process. You can get the first day absolutely free by going to my website, scribeandsunshine.com, and signing up on the homepage. Join me in my weird, ugly art revolution. Back to the show. Tell me a bit about the kind of the neuroscience of this. So what actually happens in our brains when we surrender to the process of art?
So this is a loaded question, I will say. There are multiple parts that can come up. And just for the record, I'm not a neurologist or a neuroscientist, but I'm very fascinated and spend a lot of time with the work, specifically art's role in it. In the works that I've researched and the observations I've been able to make with clients, the three parts of the brain that people tend to sit with is the Broca region, which is the one for language. The frontal lobe with the executive functioning and our ability to problem solve and make, you know, decisions. The hippocampus, which is near the brainstem, and the amygdala, which processes, you know, emotions. And so a lot of my work looks at the lens of people's lives through trauma. And what's said about trauma is that there's a, when you've been traumatized or experienced a traumatic event, something called your cortisol level hormones increase. Theoretically, after the event has happened, those are supposed to go back down. Your body goes back into homeostasis and regulates itself. Well, when you look at prolonged trauma, and particularly my interest in race-based traumatic stress, is when your body has the inability to calm back down because every day you're always like confronted with this. Mm-hmm. So these high cortisol levels are constantly at play in inhibiting the central nervous system functioning, right, that occurs. And so art comes into play because it has been shown to reduce cortisol levels. It has been shown to be able to process emotions in a way to externalize some of those traumatic events, to where those emotions are no longer like trapped and associated with that memory. And so once they're externalized, clients have the agency or the autonomy to like recreate memories and create new narratives mm-hmm. around that emotion and experience the same situation differently. Because trauma can also put us in a place of like feeling a loss of control. As far as language, trauma sometimes inhibits the ability to grab language or resource language. And art can become a form to communicate for us mm-hmm. through the sensory motor experience using a myriad of art materials. And so something that I found kind of astonishing, particularly in the psychiatric units, is that when individuals had trouble finding language and they would create these art pieces, we would use a phenomenological approach that questions the clients, like, what do you see? And they just name what they saw, whether it was like, I see yellow or I see a round object. And over time, we would reintroduce the same intervention and watch their language grow for not only the experience, but for the product that they created.
Yeah.
As far as executive functioning, like trauma can inhibit our ability to just like have frustration tolerance, imagine and think forward, and not be so impulsive in ways that can lead to self-sabotage or just harmful behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And moving through the art process in real time allows someone to do those things because often my clients are already in fear and judging themselves. I can't paint, I can't draw, I can't do these things. And what you see start to happen is their frustration happens. They might tear things up, they might throw it away, but they come back to it. Mm-hmm. And you start to see them get more intimate with the work. You start to see them have more control over the materials. You start to see them take more risk in manipulation. And by the end, you start to see me kind of out of the entire process. And now I'm just an observer. And they're no longer asking me for assistance. They're kind of telling me, today I want to work with this.
Yeah.
This is what I created type of thing. So, yeah.
I love that. I really recognized my own journey with art as you were talking, because I used to be such a perfectionist that I didn't make any art. And then I started intentionally making ugly art to just subvert that perfectionism. And slowly, yeah, like you said, it started off with me being like, yeah, this is trash. This is absolutely garbage, but it's okay because that's the intention. I'm making it ugly anyway. But then slowly it became like, oh, I can feel myself making decisions about this art piece, and I can feel myself having opinions about it that aren't just, oh, this is ugly. It's just like, oh, I would like this to go here. And then that I have the power to then do that. And then slowly have started like developing what feels like me as I create. And it's a way to like get in touch with myself and find that like moment of healing and empowerment of being able to decide what happens on the page. Mm-hmm. So I really love that.
And that process is sometimes referred as to neuroplasticity.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ability to create new wiring that influences your perception.
So cool how our brains can just change. Like we're not static. We can change. We can train ourselves to do different things and experience new things and connect to ourselves in new ways.
Mm-hmm.
Love that. Which actually, this was, I mean, my next question, we may have already answered it, but like how art helps us make new neural pathways. Like, is there something... Yeah, like what are we connecting to when we are doing this that allows us to make new neural pathways, I guess, in a way that we struggle with when we're just like trying to change a habit or, I don't know.
Well, I think it's a combination of like the cross-firing that happens across the different lobes, right? Mm-hmm. So there's like the whole sensory experience from the auditory, the gazing when you actually view art, view your own art, the touch, the sensory base. And a lot of this has been translated across various, you know, populations, you know, from PTSD, you know, veterans, from individuals who have a sensitivity to touch and things of that nature. Individuals who just have difficulty problem solving and have a more increased sensitivity to depression and anxiety. And so I think there's not one specific thing that happens in the brain. From what I've discovered is that memory is being activated, visual stimulation is being activated, auditory of how sensitivity to tone is happening, touch, body somatic. So I think it's an integral working of creating new experiences, because those new experiences then give new wiring. And so they talk about it in the way of like hormones. So like I said, like the decrease in cortisol levels, increase in dopamine. They talk about oxytocin that occurs when art then connects people to one another.
Lots going on. In my little brain.
Lots going on.
What role do you see art helping us heal ourselves and heal the world?
Art helping ourselves and heal the world. Yeah, I think there are so many possibilities, but what I'm most excited about is like the cross discipline work that's happening. Because like you say, art traditionally, or like for a long time, is just like, oh, stereotypically in school, arts and crafts, we leave it there. But we're seeing art show up in hospitals, in the medical field. And I think I get most excited about that, because a lot, like public health and health disparities that are occurring across so many populations, and challenges. And so just knowing that different fields and disciplines are getting to the point where like we can move outside of who's right and who presented the most profound research and really like come together and realize that like we all need one another. And if we can intersect from the mental health and public health perspective, especially on a policy level, then there's more invitation for arts to be in, to be reintroduced into the school, for more initiative for community art centers to exist, different language and calls for museum and galleries and their role that they have and responsibility to the community, because a lot of times they're in the heart of a community that's been disenfranchised. And so you know, and to amplify or refire places that are already using the art. So I know like sometimes it in the geriatric facilities or day centers, you know, they're doing art here and there, but with the science and mental health backing behind it, you can give your everyday person agency to kind of like speak. And this won't be just limited to scientists, professionals, like everyone can feel a part of this conversation and then see their art as powerful and their art as a solution. I know what's really cool happening now is like barbershops and salons are getting trained in mental health kit. And so even thinking about the style of art again, when it comes to hair and fashion and cooking, like it's just so much possibility. That we can now rewire how we see the gifts that we're giving to the world and see it beyond a moment in time, but an ability to like actually heal and support someone and have the science to kind of to back what we already have like been knowing or acting out.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that tapestry that you kind of wove there of all of these things coming together and all being equally important. And especially that feeling of connection through art that isn't just like, oh, the people who make these very famous paintings that
right.
like, those are given the spotlight. It's like, no, just these community centers where people in the community can share mm-hmm. their art and feel that importance, feel that connection together. I love that.
Right, right. Yeah. And with it, the accessibility is just kind of like normalized.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Where you Absolutely. Can walk past a piece of chalk and like if you just feel like drawing, just like draw, you know?
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful world coming to us. Do you have any last thoughts on this time that we find ourselves in? Kind of this work that we have ahead of us. And I mean, there's different kinds of work, you know, like my work in decolonizing my own brain and figuring out my role in liberation and connection mm-hmm. is different than your role as a healer for race-based trauma. And mm-hmm. So I guess, yeah, any final parts, thoughts on that?
I just think art can help us navigate some of these things, these complex issues, these complex emotions, mm-hmm. while also just like humanizing us, you know, in our uniqueness.
Yeah.
Conversation starters. Like I said, what I shared with you before of how like words can be so limiting
mm-hmm.
and it can just send people into a rabbit hole. Like, well, I really didn't mean that. I should have used this word. And art just serves as a sense of like remaining inquisitive about people.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just like, it's only so many words you can use about a lot of things. But with art, I mean, wow, you can just like go from painting to drawing to clay to cardboard
mm-hmm.
to flowers to sand to dirt to, you know, it's just endless
mm-hmm.
on what you can use art with. So think about one person using or having the opportunity to use an endless amount of art and how much work you will get and how many different entry points you will get into who that person is.
Yeah.
It reduces the opportunity of like judgment and just increases like curiosity to really like understand the whole person.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one thing. I think the last thing would be to just like encourage people to start with your story.
Mm-hmm.
Because oftentimes I get the question of like, you know, well, what can I do? Like, how can I? And I'm like, you know, I could tell you to go for a walk in nature. I can tell you to, you know, go to a museum or to take an art class, but often those things become moments because somewhere along the way, you have that gap that leads in judgment or that critic or that fear. And then now these are just moments in time and that person is going on to the next class or the next exhibition, but your story stays with you forever.
Yeah.
And it's always walking with you, no matter what setting you're in, your story is with you. And so having more belief and confidence in what your own story has to tell and finding ways in which you would dissect a particular experience or you would reclaim a particular emotion that you had happened, or how would you communicate this, you know, to your peers or your family? It's so much there. And yeah. I think we doubt how powerful our own narrative is.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely do. Yeah, that's so good. At the end of every episode, I like to ask my guests, what is something ugly you've made recently?
What is something ugly I made? Interpretation of ugly.
Yeah, however you want to interpret that.
Right. What is something ugly I've made? Because these pineapple things are beautiful. I've just been creating those.
No, those are amazing.
I mean, well, okay. My food is typically ugly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like the idea is so beautiful in my head, and it's like whether I follow the recipe or not, like I like what needs to be there is there, but the presentation, it just be like, what?
Yep.
I'm like, what?
I agree with
it. It tastes so good.
it never looks like the pictures ever.
It never looks like the pictures. It doesn't look like, so I'm just like, what is missing here? So yeah, I've made some ugly food in the past couple weeks.
Does it still taste good though?
It really is good. It is good. confusing as I'm eating it, but good.
good. I love that. Thank you so much for being here and for sharing your knowledge with me and our listeners, my listeners. Where can people find you and how can they support your work?
Yeah, I'm on Pineapples with Purpose at Instagram. So just Pineapples with an S with Purpose. My website is also pineappleswithpurpose.com, www. What else am I on? Is that it? Yeah, I think that's it. And my email is april@pineappleswithpurpose.com.
Amazing.
How can you support my work? I do have a website that in the next couple of weeks I'll be reopening for purchase on prints of my work.
Great.
Yeah, I think that's what comes to mind so far.
Great. Amazing. And if you want to see some of April's work outside of Instagram, in the show notes, I will have a list of other places where you can find some of her work. So dope. definitely check out the show notes because April's done a lot of really cool stuff. All right.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. Thank you so much for being on here. And everybody, thank you for listening and keep doing the work, keep healing yourself and keep it ugly. The Ugly Podcast is created by me, Lauren Alexander of Scribe and Sunshine. It is produced and sort of edited, also by me, and written and directed by absolutely nobody. If you like the podcast, be sure to rate and leave a review on your preferred platform and share with the creative people in your life. If you're interested in learning more about what I do, head to scribeandsunshine.com to learn more about my Ugly Art 101 course, my Perfectionism Workshop, my editing services, and the Writer's Helm, which is an online community for writers co-captained by myself and Gabby Goodlow. As always, keep it ugly.